I'm Jeffrey Rosen, the President and CEO of the National Constitution Center. Welcome to the latest of our series of constitutional podcasts. Today, we're going to talk about NSA surveillance and the question of whether the NSA's telephone metadata surveillance program is consistent with the Constitution and with Section 215 of the USA Patriot Act. In September, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court released a previously secret opinion upholding the National Security Agency's mass surveillance of telephone metadata under both the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution and Section 215 of the Patriot Act. The Electronic Privacy Information Center, or EPIC, has asked the Supreme Court to review the legality of the surveillance program. Justice Antonin Scalia said last month that he expects the court eventually to hear a version of the case. And now that review looks more likely than ever. In February 2013, the Supreme Court said that government wireless surveillance laws can't be challenged in court because plaintiffs don't have standing to sue over secret procedures that they're not directly aware of. But the New York Times recently reported that the Justice Department will, for the first time, allow prosecutors to tell a criminal defendant that evidence against him came from warrantless surveillance, and that could open the door to a Supreme Court challenge both of the constitutional and statutory basis of the surveillance program and of the government's previous refusal to reveal the source of evidence obtained by wireless and warrantless surveillance. To debate this fascinating subject, we're joined by two of the leading authorities in the world, Mark Rotenberg of the Electronic Privacy Information Center and Orrin Kerr of the George Washington University Law Center. Welcome to both of you. We're going to begin by asking the question of the constitutional arguments for and against the NSA's telephone surveillance program. The FISA court upheld the surveillance program against a Fourth Amendment challenge and said essentially that citizens had no expectation of privacy in their telephone metadata. Mark Rotenberg, could you describe the FISA court's arguments rejecting the constitutional challenge to the surveillance program, and tell us what you think about those arguments?
Well, Jeff, the court's argument, at least with respect to the constitutional claims, turns on an interpretation of a 1979 Supreme Court case called Smith versus Maryland. And in that case, the Supreme Court held that one did not have an expectation of privacy with regard to the telephone numbers dialed, unlike the content of the communication, which the Supreme Court had held a decade earlier, was protected under the Fourth Amendment. And following from the reasoning of Smith versus Maryland, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court this year, now more than, 30 years after the Smith versus Maryland decision, reasoned that in similar fashion, the government could routinely collect all telephone records of all U.S. telephone customers without implicating a Fourth Amendment interest.
That's very well summarized. And as you say, the FISA court did rest on the Smith case, and it said the Supreme Court found in a 1979 case, Smith versus Maryland, that once a person has transmitted this telephone metadata information to a third party, in this case a telephone company, the person has no legitimate expectation of privacy in the information. Orrin, Mark has summarized the court's holding. Let me first ask you what you think of that constitutional analysis, and then I'll ask Mark what he thinks.
I think the court's constitutional analysis is correct. Not only did the Supreme Court say in Smith versus Maryland that the numbers dialed from a telephone call are not protected when obtained from the telephone company because they're the telephone company's business records, but lower courts have applied that rule quite broadly in cases since Smith versus Maryland. Most recently, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals decided a case just a few months ago saying that cell site information, that is records of where a cell phone is located when a call is placed, are similarly not protected. The basic idea is that there's a difference between information about a call and the content of the call itself, and you could draw an analogy to a postal letter. The traditional Fourth Amendment rule for postal letters is that the contents of the letter is protected. The letter is sealed and the government needs a warrant to open it, but the government can look at the outside of the letter, the postmark, the to-from address, to find out what's on the outside of the package without triggering the Fourth Amendment. So this is basically the same rule as applied to telephone calls. The one sort of interesting wrinkle to this is that the government is obtaining lots of records at the same time. In fact, not only lots, but millions of records at the same time, rather than sort of person by person. So there's interesting questions as to whether that should make a difference. Should there be a different rule for large-scale surveillance than there is for case-by-case surveillance? It seems to me that under current Fourth Amendment law, the answer is that should not make a difference because, the Fourth Amendment is a personal right. It protects an individual right. And so collecting information about multiple people is just that individual right repeated. And in general, if something is not a search, if it's done many times, it's still not a search. Zero times whatever number still equals zero. So it seems to me that unless we start talking about some pretty interesting, start talking about doctrinal innovations, way of changing existing law, just based on sort of a boring read the cases and go where they go approach, it seems to me that the FISA court was correct in saying that this is not a Fourth Amendment problem.
Well argued. Mark Oren has defended the court's analysis, noting that although there's a difference between this case and Smith, and that in Smith the government was getting a few dialed telephone numbers of one person suspected of a crime, and here it got millions of telephone numbers of lots of people suspected of no crime. In fact, under current doctrine, the court held this doesn't matter. And in particular, the court said, as Oren did, when one individual does not have a Fourth Amendment interest, grouping together a large number of similarly situated individuals cannot result in a Fourth Amendment interest springing into existence ex nihilo. Mark, what do you make of that argument?
Well, I think Oren has, fairly played out the logic of the Smith opinion, and certainly from the government's perspective, one would not back off what appears to be on its face favorable case law for a position that you're trying to defend. At the same time, I think, as we might say about some other cases, this is not your father's trap and trace device. We're in a very different world in the 21st century with the collection and use of telephone records than we were in the 1970s, the era of the rotary phone, the analog network, very little ability actually to collate and databine information about telephone callers. But even without going to that big contrast between the era when Smith was decided and our current era, I think the opinion itself and the dissents actually point us in what may be a new direction if the court is given the opportunity to reconsider the doctrine. First of all, we certainly know on the facts of Smith that there were indicators of criminal activity that gave rise to the police interest in a particular target, and it was that particular target's telephone numbers that were ultimately obtained. That core requirement for some degree of individualized suspicion seems to be absolutely lacking in the current NSA telephone record collection program. It was present in Smith. It may not have been enough to justify a Fourth Amendment interest, but it does distinguish the two circumstances. And then there were two important dissents in that case, one by Justice Marshall that spoke to the assumption of risk as to whether or not people actually knew that their telephone numbers could be collected in the way that they were, which I think is a very important point to keep in mind as we think about the very sophisticated technology in the modern telephone network and how much information is not only collected but also generated, completely unbeknownst to the telephone user. So at some level, we have to ask the question, how can possibly people give up an interest in personal data that they didn't know existed? That's one point in the dissent. And the point in the other dissent concerns the sensitivity of the telephone numbers that are being dialed. And so we think, for example, how revealing it can be, particularly today when you can take a telephone number and Google it, essentially running it through a reverse directory, learn immediately who someone called, and then over time construct a very detailed pattern about their interests and activities. So I think today it's a much more compelling to make the argument that there are very significant Fourth Amendment interests implicated by the routine collection of so much telephone information.
Corin, what do you make of Mark's three points? He says the difference in Smith is there was a degree of individualized suspicion. It was more realistic to imagine that people knew, and mass surveillance reveals a great deal more information. And I guess I'd ask you to answer not, you know, what would the court hold under current doctrine, but if you were thinking from scratch, what do you think the right Fourth Amendment answer is here?
Yeah, I don't think the Fourth Amendment can hinge on what people know for the reason that ironically that would mean that Edward Snowden eliminated Fourth Amendment rights in the United States. That would be kind of an ironic result. So I think sort of trying to figure out what people actually do know is not really the underlying question. And I think the hard question is, once you say that the Fourth Amendment protection jumps from contents of communications, where I think we would all agree the Fourth Amendment applies, to non-content information, how far do you take that? So there are lots of different kinds of non-content records. There's location information, there's to-from calling information, there's basic subscriber information. The providers collect a lot of information, and it's not just phone calls, internet records, credit card records, bank statements. How far do you take the rationale of saying that it's all protected under the Fourth Amendment, and then what level of protection do you give that information? And my concern is, first, it's actually really unclear once you start looking into non-content information where you stop and you say, okay, the following things are categorically not protected and the other things are, and what levels of Fourth Amendment protection you give. So Mark, you know, points out, well, in the Smith versus Maryland case, there was reason to think that Smith was involved in the crime. While that's true, that wasn't really what the reasoning of the court was about. And then you have to start saying, well, you know, is there a lower than probable cause thresholds for less sensitive information? And pretty soon you end up having to write a statute that has dozens, if not hundreds, of moving parts. And I see that as a job for the legislature, not the courts. I think it's an incredibly complicated problem that requires drawing lots of different distinctions from a standpoint of policy. And I don't think it's something that the courts really have the institutional capacity to do. And I also don't think it's proper for them to try to take on this issue, which I see as a policy question, not a constitutional question. So I think ultimately Mark's points are great points for Congress to grapple with, but less relevant for the courts to grapple with in trying to interpret the Fourth Amendment.
What about that, Mark? Why shouldn't it be Congress, not the courts, that solve this?
Well, actually, in large part, I agree with Oren's point. In fact, I had something to do with trying to address the Smith versus Maryland problem when I worked on the 1986 amendments to the Federal Wiretap Act, the so-called Electronic Communications Privacy Act. And one of the things that we did there was to create a statutory standard for access to trap and trace and pen register information, largely in response to the court's decision in Smith versus Maryland. And in doing that, it recognized that there was a lower standard, not no standard, but a lower standard for access to the so-called cover information, referring back to the analogy that Oren proposed with regard to postal letters, than there would be for the enclosed content, which I think is correct. So sometimes you do need Congress to step in. But here's another part of the interesting conversation between the court and the Congress about the scope of privacy in the U.S. is that other times I think you need the court to signal to Congress where there's a significant underlying interest and then leave to Congress the work of detailing how that interest is going to be recognized in practice. So if you hit rewind on the tape and go back to the Federal Wiretap Act of 1968, comprehensive law enacted by Congress, it's clear that that was a response to two decisions by the Supreme Court in the prior year, which were both Katz and Berger. And in those two cases, the Supreme Court made quite clear that there was a Fourth Amendment interest in the content of telephone communications, and even state regulations that were not sufficient to protect that interest had to be narrowed further. So Congress, you know, took the lead from the court, and that's how we got the modern-day framework. So I think my view is that we have two different models for how the Congress and court interact specifically around the Wiretap Act, and what we need at this point is the court to look a little bit more closely at the significance of the privacy implications of data collection, which I think they started to do, in fact, in Jones. I think Jones is a half step towards recognizing the Fourth Amendment interest in telephone record information.
So some agreement that congressional engagement might be appropriate, but Mark suggests that the court does need to nudge by examining the Fourth Amendment interest. On that point, just our last turn on the constitutional question, Oren, if we were starting from scratch, isn't there a difference between one individual search and a mass search of millions or billions of records? I mean, weren't the framers of the Fourth Amendment centrally concerned about general warrants, which would authorize mass searches without particularized suspicion? And even if it's true that it's hard to draw lines about exactly what kind of content or metadata is protected, isn't that a powerful historical response to the FISA court's effort just to say that there's no difference between one individual search and the amalgamation of lots of individual searches?
I don't think that the analogy to general warrants works, because the key prohibition on general warrants is that the government's not allowed to break into many people's homes. They're not allowed to, for example, go into everybody's house looking for evidence. That doesn't mean that the agents, the government's agents, are not allowed to look at people out in a public street. The government is allowed to post a police officer in the city street, and the officer can look in public at whoever he wants to look at. That's not regulated by the Fourth Amendment at all. And I think when we're talking about acquiring non-content records, that's sort of, we're going to draw implicitly or explicitly some sort of a physical analogy, that the non-content records are analogous to the kind of information that the government would observe out in public, and the contents of the communications are analogous to the kind of information that is that the government would observe in a private home. So the difficulty, I think, with the general warrant analogy at a conceptual level is that it's talking about breaking into homes, that is, breaking into contents, and here we're only talking about non-content records. And I do think if you do regulate the bulk collection problem, you run into some really hard line-drawing problems that are just generally tough for the courts to deal with. So, for example, let's say the court said you can't collect everyone's phone call metadata at once. Well, what is the NSA going to do? They're going to say, okay, we can't collect everyone, so we're going to collect 90% of people's records. And then a court's going to have to say, no, you can't collect 90%, and then the government's going to collect 89%. And you're going to end up with a cat-and-mouse game, whereas if the court says, you know, let's say hypothetically a court said you can only collect 1% of the American public's records, well, then the government's going to get, you know, 100 different court orders in order to try to collect the 100%. So it's something that the legislature can step in and say, here's the arbitrary rule, we adopt the following line, period, and no one can question the basis of that, but Congress can do it if they want to. I think it's just really tough for the courts to play this sort of cat and mouse game with the executive branch over time, in part because it takes so many years for cases to go before the court, and whereas the executive branch is constantly looking for ways to, you know, formally comply with the Supreme Court precedents, but they may not be, you know, entirely faithful to the spirit of those precedents.
Mark, your response to those two interesting points. First, Oren says first, really, if we have no expectation of privacy in the metadata, the cops can look at one person's metadata or millions of people, just as they could look at one or millions of people for a moment on the street. Are you persuaded by that first argument?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't cede that point. Obviously, you know, we believe that there is a significant privacy interest in metadata. In fact, I think over time it's only increased. There's a good argument, in fact, that in the digital world as opposed to the analog world, the value of the data is actually greater than the underlying content, because it's the metadata, the information about events and communications, that can be more easily analyzed and linked and assessed than the underlying communications themselves. So from the privacy perspective, I don't have a difficulty arguing that the privacy interest may actually be greater in our modern world, and that our legal paradigm is almost inverted as to how it protects the interest. But nonetheless, I do agree with Oren. I mean, I think it's a very difficult problem from almost any perspective, trying to imagine, you know, where we draw these lines, understanding that courts move slowly when they confront these issues. But I think on this point, my answer to Oren would be, I don't think the government can escape the obligation, nor can the institution of the court, to confront these questions when they arise. I mean, it would be nice, of course, to wish away the legal concerns associated with a telephone record collection program, but that doesn't answer the problem, which is that there seems to be today almost unbounded record collection being undertaken on U.S. telephone customers. And, you know, looking at that from the outside, I think most legal experts would say, well, that just seems to go a little bit too far. Then we have to figure out how to create some meaningful oversight.
Because this is important, I'm going to ask one final question on the constitutional aspect. Oren, the court said in the Jones case, of course, that month-long surveillance of someone's public movements is impermissible without a warrant because it can reveal so much about us. Why wouldn't the ubiquitous collection of all of someone's telephone calls, even if it's only metadata, raise similar concerns because it also has the potential to reconstruct so much about our private lives?
You know, it might raise similar concerns, but that was not the reasoning of the majority opinion in Jones. So the Supreme Court in Jones ends up breaking off. There's a five-justice majority opinion, which focuses only on the physical installation and use of the device, and then the concurring opinions go into the possibility that maybe the use should have been regulated instead of the installation. I think it's possible to make an argument that we should get to a very different result under the Jones concurring opinions, but at least so far, lower courts have, in my mind, properly said that those are just concurring opinions. They're not the majority opinion of the court. So, and I should say, this is something that future courts may take the concurring opinions of Jones and run with them and create some interesting doctrinal innovations, and it may all get back to the Supreme Court someday, and the Supreme Court will decide what to do. But at least just based on current law, that was, you know, the Jones majority opinion was on a narrower rationale that doesn't implicate these concerns.
Mark, if you were running with the Jones concurrence, do you think that would be a strong argument against the constitutionality of this, this program?
I mean, as I said, I think Jones is a half step toward reversing Smith versus Maryland. It obviously didn't go the full distance, but there's clearly a shadow majority there for the proposition that the routine collection of personal data, in that case obtained by GPS device, implicates the type of privacy interest described in CATS. And if that's correct, and five justices of the court seem to think it was, then with the proper case before the court, I think you see a very different result than you did in 1979.
Great. Thanks for an extremely thoughtful ventilation of the constitutional arguments for and against the surveillance program. Let's turn now to the statutory arguments, in particular, Section 215 of the USA Patriot Act. Section 215 requires any valid order to include, quote, a statement of facts showing that there are reasonable grounds to believe that the tangible things sought are relevant to an authorized investigation. In her opinion for the FISA court, Judge Egan omitted the last words of the statutory language to an authorized investigation and offered the legal requirement in this way. She said, the government may meet the standard under Section 215 if it can demonstrate reasonable grounds to believe that the information sought to be produced has some bearing on its investigations, plural, of the identified international terrorist organizations. Oren, do you find that a persuasive reading of the statutory requirements of Section 215?
I don't think it's a persuasive reading of Section 215. And when it was disclosed that the FISA court had interpreted Section 215 to allow this program, I was quite surprised. I mean, sort of to see how what a aggressive reading of the statute this is, realize that Section 215 is essentially a grand jury subpoena power in the national security setting. The grand jury subpoena power is the power that every prosecutor around the country has to compel third parties to disclose documents. And the basic idea is they can order the disclosure of relevant documents, but they can't go overboard. They can't order too many documents. They can't require the third party to, you know, sort of hand over everything. And effectively, the FISA court interpreted Section 215 to allow the government to require the phone company to hand over absolutely everything. On the theory, for the FISA court's reading to be correct, it would have to be also the result that any prosecutor could have also compelled every phone record in the United States on an ongoing basis from any grand jury subpoena case. And it's completely inconceivable to me that that would be the case. And to my mind, the heart of the court's error, there are a few grounds on which I think the FISA court's opinion is unpersuasive just as a matter of statutory interpretation. But to my mind, the real nub of the opinion that just strikes me as unpersuasive is the court argues effectively that the getting all of the phone records is relevant and is not overbroad because it's necessary to get all the records for the government to pursue its investigations. How do we know it's necessary for the government to get the entire database? Because the executive branch says that it's necessary to get the entire database. So effectively, the Section 215 becomes a power to obtain every record in the United States because in secret, the executive branch told the FISA court that it'd be really useful to have every record in the United States. And it's just so far removed from the statutory language, it's just very difficult to imagine just reading a language that you would think that it could justify that kind of a program. So I think the FISA court should be rightly criticized for construing Section 15 in that aggressive a fashion.
Powerful criticism. Mark, I'll ask your thoughts in a moment, but I need to follow up by asking, Orrin, if you believe that the program is not authorized by Section 215, should the Supreme Court, if it chooses to review the case, hold that the program is illegal?
Well, it's very difficult, I think, for the Supreme Court to review this, in part because the statute itself doesn't seem to contemplate Supreme Court review, at least in any direct way. And it's very hard to know if the Supreme Court granted review in this case, what exactly they would review. Are they supposed to conduct a plenary review of every potential legal issue that goes into whether the statute was complied with? Ordinarily, when the Supreme Court takes a case, they look at a very specific issue and they say, okay, here's one specific word in the statute. Should it be interpreted this way or that way? It's hard for me to think of what the Supreme Court would even decide if they were to review a case like this. So I think the remedy for the FISA court's misinterpretation of the law is primarily a political remedy. It is Congress amending the statute to either reverse this decision or at least amend the decision in some way to bring back the law either to where it was or at least to have the executive branch have to justify this program. And it's not a great answer, I'll concede at the outset, in part because it means that the FISA court has effectively interpreted the law in secret to give the government power that's very hard to walk back, because, of course, the president is not going to want to limit the power of the surveillance authorities of in the national security setting. He has veto power over legislation, and, of course, he's also in charge of the national security surveillance program. So it's a very difficult problem, and to my mind, it really points to the need to reform the FISA court at a structural level. So I think it's a tough situation we're in with this program, and probably the most effective thing we can do going forward is to have Congress restructure the FISA court so the FISA court is not in a position of only hearing from one side and adopting kind of aggressive readings of the statute, which allow programs that just based on a plain reading of the law you wouldn't think should be allowed.
Mark, what are your thoughts after Orrin's very thoughtful response?
Well,
EPIC has challenged the program in court. What do you think the Supreme Court should do in light of your shared belief that it's not justified by Section 215, first of all? This is my first question.
Sure. Well, let me say actually in answering your question, Jeff, Orrin made three important points, and I agree with two of the points that he made. Certainly, our view is that the FISA court did misconstrue Section 215 of the Patriot Act for lots of reasons. There's just a lack of logical coherence in looking at qualifying phrases in a law and producing an outcome that's essentially unbounded with respect to authorities. So to find meaning in the qualifying terms in 215, you have to be able to draw some lines, and the court's opinion in the government's defense doesn't seem to allow for that. I'd also agree with Oren's last point about the need for structural reform in the FISA. I think several of the proposals that are currently pending in Congress, several of the steps that have already been taken, including the publication of the opinions from the court, providing more data about the use of FISA authority, as well as proposals to create some type of public adversary, are good recommendations and reforms that will make the decision-making of the court more robust, which probably is a better outcome all around. But the key point, and I think the one that bears discussing in a little bit more detail, is whether the Supreme Court should take this case. And, you know, we think quite strongly that it should. We were very sensitive to the concerns that we knew that scholars and experts would raise about going to the Supreme Court in the first instance, because everything about our legal system disfavors that for lots of reasons. We like lower courts to consider matters carefully before they reach the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court is the ultimate arbiter. But here we felt we had a good reason to go to the court, and just in brief, let me say what it is. And that is that you have a decision of a lower court, of an inferior court, interpreting law. You have a specific order that was issued by a specific judge that compelled a private company to disclose all of the records on its customers to the federal government, to the National Security Agency. And the question we are simply asking is this: was that a lawful act? Did the court have the authority to issue that order? We kept it as narrow as we could. We didn't even raise the constitutional objections. We simply looked at the legal standard. And if the answer to that question is no, it did not have the authority to issue the order, then the question you have to answer next is, well, who is going to tell that court that they exceeded their authority? It's hard to imagine another Article III court telling the FISA court that they exceeded their authority, and in fact the government has argued that other Article III courts, and by this I mean district courts, can review that order. We have no basis to go to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court of Review because we lack standing there by the terms of the statute itself. Really, the only court that we could go to appeal the judgment of the FISA court is the U.S. Supreme Court. And it's therefore by process of elimination, but proceeding from the well-founded belief that the court had exceeded its authority, that we ultimately submitted the petition we did.
Oren, I want to wrap up by asking about the significance of this Obama administration's announcement recently that the Justice Department will, in future cases and for the first time, allow prosecutors to tell criminal defendants that evidence against them derived from warrantless surveillance. Does that make it more likely that a challenge, either statutory or constitutional, to the substance of the surveillance program will get before the Supreme Court? And or is it more likely that the previous policy, which was not to disclose this evidence to defendants, will be the basis for a legal challenge? What are the consequences of this recent policy shift in terms of getting the case before the Supreme Court?
Yeah, it's certainly an important switch in Justice Department policy, and it's going to allow more challenges to different surveillance practices. I think the question of Supreme Court review is still relatively remote, in that the lower court has to first, on the merits, decide the constitutional issue. Usually, the Supreme Court's not going to step in unless there's some sort of disagreement in the lower court. So it's not obvious to me that issues are going to get directly to the Supreme Court, at least in any rapid fashion. And I think also it's important. One of the issues that courts are going to have to grapple with if they start hearing these cases is when criminal defendants file a motion to suppress based on their Fourth Amendment rights being violated, typically courts only consider the surveillance that was occurred in their case, sort of what happened to their records, what were they surveilled at. The search, the statute that the surveillance was justified under is generally not at issue. In fact, the statute usually just creates a basis for narrowing the scope of the exclusionary rule under a decision called Illinois versus Kroll. The scope of the exclusionary rule is narrower when the government relies on a statute authorizing a search than it would be otherwise. And what that means is that it may be difficult to challenge directly the underlying surveillance, either because it may be that the exclusionary rule doesn't apply, so criminal defendants can't invoke it, or it may be that the surveillance of an individual defendant is not one that directly implicates the core judgments underlying the statute itself. So I don't think we're going to see, or at least I'm skeptical that we're going to see, a direct facial challenge to the statute that's going to get to the Supreme Court and allow the Supreme Court to say yes or no. I think it's much more likely we're going to see individual cases in which individual types of surveillance are allowed or not allowed, and those cases may not get that far in light of limits to the exclusionary rule.
Very thoughtful response, Mark. What do you think the consequences of the Obama administration's policy shift will be in terms of getting these cases before the Supreme Court?
Well, I think one of the key points here is that we're beginning to see that there are real problems using acts like the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act to gather evidence for prosecution of crime in traditional proceedings, largely because those statutes do so much to keep secret the methods by which information is gathered. And this is a very sharp contrast to the traditional framework for the gathering of electronic surveillance and the use in criminal proceedings that was set out in the 1968 Act. I'm oftentimes struck by the fact that the original Title III required notification to all the targets of surveillance once an investigation was concluded. There was the expectation that people should know that their telephone calls were listened into by the federal government. There's nothing like that happening today with the use of FISA authorities in terms of targets, and that's a reflection, of course, of the lower standards that were established by Congress in 1978 when the Act was adopted. So I think we're beginning to see a shift, but I also think it's perhaps an anticipation of more challenges to the way that evidence is being gathered through the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act.
Orrin Kerr, Mark Rotenberg, I have to thank you for a superb discussion of the complicated and fascinating legal issues involved with NSA surveillance, fully in the tradition of the National Constitution Center congressional mandate to disseminate information about the United States Constitution on a nonpartisan basis. Thank you so much, and look forward to joining again soon.